Hello, I'm Rob Hirschfeld, CEO and co-founder of Rakuten and your host for the Cloud 2030 podcast. In this episode, we dive deeply into DHCP, PXIe, iPXIe, UEFI BIOS, and all of the things necessary to do network installs of servers and, incidentally, thin clients and PCs and other network switches and things like that. But specifically, we talk about the process of having secure and robust network provisioning for infrastructure. We go down deep. We talk about all the pieces that you need to know, how the processes work, both in legacy and in modern current systems. I know you will get a lot out of this discussion. I'm going to frame this, if it's all right, I'll start a little bit less technical, and then I'd love to have one of our team jump in and walk through the process, because it's not as simple as I'm going to make it sound. Right. So the PXIe DHCP question here is all about, how do you start a machine that doesn't have an operating system on it? And what is the sequence of steps that you go through to install an operating system? Or an operating environment, if you want, on a machine, and that's fundamentally the problem that we're trying to solve. And there's a couple of ways to solve it, and we've worked through many of them, going all the way back to my early days, where you can walk up with a USB stick and install something. What we're trying to do here is do something that doesn't require you to physically access the device. So the process we're talking about here is to be able to do it from having the machine plugged in, attached to a network, and then initiate a sequence of events that installs the operating system. And for that reason, and one of the things I think people don't think about that much is that PXIe really starts from the network topology and the NIC card, even from a onboarding perspective. Does somebody on the Rakuten team want to walk through the sequence? I know we have graphics. Let me see if I can pull up a graphic. Although I'd rather us walk through it, because I'm just because of the way we're recording this. Anybody want to start? Take a pass on the sequence? I was thinking starting from DHCP.
Okay. How detailed do you want me to be?
Pretty detailed. I think it's helpful.
Okay. So to start off with, DHCP is where everything starts. DHCP is all about being able to configure hosts to talk to their local network. These days, it's pretty much all IPv4 with some IPv6 thrown in, but we don't handle that yet. And what DHCP is responsible for is allowing a host that doesn't have any IP address to get one, along with all the other options that needs to communicate with the local network and the wider internet beyond. So DHCP is responsible for handing out IP addresses. It's responsible for handing out various options to control what DNS server you're going to use, what router you're going to talk to, and other local service things. DHCP as a protocol is pretty old. It is an extension to an even older protocol called BootP, which we won't get into because it's only relevant in exactly one use case that we cover, and nothing else anymore.
I forget about BootP. You're right.
Yeah. That dependency is completely gone in DHCP version 6 because no one cares about BootP anymore except for a very large blue 3-letter company. But if you get on the internet these days, you're using DHCP for pretty much everything on your local laptop and in an awful lot of server environments as well, because no one wants to manually configure systems to get on the internet anymore. So where PXIe comes into play is DHCP, in addition to handing out the IP addresses, it has a pretty flexible space for passing for DHCP clients to say what options they're interested in getting, and for DHCP servers to satisfy those options. And PXIe, is essentially DHCP plus a couple of bonus options that tell the system where to download a file and how to execute it. In the graph that we're talking about, C sort of sits embedded in DHCP with a little bit of the second stage for TFTP. One of the options that a server can ask for is give me a file to boot from. And that is where Pixie comes into play. For both legacy BIOS systems and for UEFI systems, Pixie is accomplished from a network and an end user standpoint by downloading an executable for the system that's trying to boot and then rerunning it. And after that, it's up to the executable that gets downloaded to handle everything else in the process. The graph that Rob is showing is for a legacy BIOS boot because it's asking for LPixie Linux.0. And that is only, that particular bootloader only supports legacy. And LPixie Linux has its own flow for getting the rest of the boot config files. That's not going to be the same across all the other bootloaders.
So, I mean, part of the reason it's like this is because we're talking about starting from firmware, which historically is meant to be pretty lightweight and simple. So, this TFTP is, it's a UDP-based protocol. It's super minimal flow control. Yeah.
You mentioned USB keys. This process is older than USB keys.
Okay, fair enough. USB keys did not exist when I was in the first times I was Pixie booting. You're right. It used to use ISOs and drives.
Actual CD-ROM drives or piles of floppy diskettes. That's what Pixie replaced.
Okay. Yeah, so even more like a USB would be like, oh, that's not so bad. And at some point, I wanted to talk through the idea. Actually, let me do it this way. So what if, if you wanted, could you just put LPixie on a USB stick and say boot from this every time and leave it installed? How would that work? Like skip this first TFTP step?
You couldn't put LPixie on a USB stick, but you could put ISO Linux on a Pixie stick, which looks almost exactly like LPixie, except it loads from, will pull things from a local ISO instead of communicating over the network.
That makes sense. Okay.
That's LPixie specific. If you use something else like iPixie, which is another pretty popular bootloader that works for both, has various for legacy boot. UEFI, not in secure mode for x86 and for ARM64, you can do that. You can burn a tiny little UEFI executable onto a USB stick or even a CD-ROM with an embedded config file to say, go finish doing the rest of your stuff on this server over there.
How does it get the information it needs to fit? Because that's just basically a kernel to get you started. Mm-hmm. How does it know what to do next? Like, do you still have to provide it some, like, get on the net? You still have to get it on the network and provide some options, right?
So that's one of the key differences between how LPixie Linux or, ISO Linux would work in this case versus iPixie, is that LPixie Linux uses cached information that it gets from the DHCP stuff. It doesn't go off and do its own second DHCP handshake to get more information. It relies on its own little config thing. So if it wasn't booted from DHCP, it won't have the options there. It won't know where to go talk to a TFTP server. It won't know what boot files to load. With iPixie, whenever iPixie loads, it does another DHCP handshake with a different set of options that the DHCP server can recognize and say, I've already loaded the iPixie bootloader. And now it wants a config file, so I'm going to hand back the config file for iPixie instead of the iPixie bootloader again and continue on my merry way with whatever config file it serves me.
So it's actually a different DHCP interaction from that perspective. It's new. It doesn't have to get a new address, but the DHCP server needs to understand that it's a new environment.
Once the bootloader is in memory and executing, it can do whatever it wants.
Okay.
So that's how iPixie would work in this scenario you're describing.
Doesn't iPixie have like a skip the whole TFTP and just go to HTTP or HTTPS?
Yes, because it includes its own network stack instead of relying on the firmware's network stack to do all of its work. It has its own little HTTP client. It has its own TFTP client. In some cases, it even has its own drivers that you can use in place of whatever the firmware provides.
And is it still a specialized OS from that perspective? Like, it's basically a bootstrapping OS? Or is it?
No, you could call it that.
Okay.
It's very limited in what it can do, but yes, you could call it that.
Yeah, let's not forget also that one of the major use cases of Pixie back in the day was for thin clients.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they could download whatever firmware blob they needed to do their business and download whatever configuration they needed for their local situation and do whatever they needed. We don't really support thin clients like that, mostly because it tends to get into hyper-specialized emitter-specific stuff real fast. But the standard server Pixie paths they've been standardized for, 25 years now?
What do you mean by a specialized path?
Going back to what I said earlier, the basic idea of Pixie is, DHCP tells you to download an executable that will do a thing.
Okay.
What that executable does and how it handles the next steps is totally up to the executable. In that sense, Pixie kind of stops once the initial bootloader is loaded into memory and running. At that point, you're doing whatever the bootloader wants. For the common server bootloaders, those behaviors are also standardized around go get a config file and do whatever it says to do, which is usually to load a kernel, load an initial RAM disk, load some configuration, and start a real operating system.
Okay. So that would be NetBoot.
The blob that it download could be, and here's what you're going to run on the thin client, have fun. Or it could be, here's a config blob for the operating system you already have configured so that we can, do whatever it is that thin client needs to do.
Yeah. And they might be much more hardware specific because of the security implications then.
Yeah.
And which brings up like the secure boot piece. When we talk about secure boot, is that is that eliminating TFTP and HTTP and jumping straight into an HTTPS? Where does the secure part of the secure boot start from?
All secure boot does from the perspective of Pixie booting. First, obviously, it can only work in UEFI because legacy BIOS is just inherently not secure and it can't be made secure.
Okay. Makes sense.
But from a secure boot standpoint, what that means is that the bootloader that you get sent back has to be signed by a firmware key or by a key that the firmware knows about.
Okay.
Which is why we can't use iPixie for UEFI secure boot, because iPixie doesn't publish signed releases signed by a key that most firmware has embedded into it. So from a secure boot standpoint, the only difference between what's in this graph and what happens in secure boot is after the client gets the boot file, it checks to make sure that it's signed by a key that it knows about. And if it's not, secure boot stops. It won't execute.
And that's so when I think about like early Pixie, I always thought it was the firmware was mainly in the network card. But it must have been more in the BIOS than I was thinking about.
So Intel has an entire Pixie spec that goes through the interactions that the NIC firmware and the BIOS have to be able to accomplish for legacy BIOS.
Okay.
The overwhelming majority of that spec is not relevant to anyone who isn't writing firmware, isn't writing a BIOS. It is used as kind of the source of truth for the options that DHCP has to know about in order to enable
it. But in a UEFI BIOS, UEFI BIOS scenario, in that case, that is the thing that's bringing in this executable, the new bootloader, and then it's checking the signatures before it hands off execution. So it's a UEFI BIOS piece. And those keys are basically injected by the whoever manufactures that gear the first time. And once you're in secure mode, then you can't, I mean, I guess you could go onto the machine and turn out a secure mode, but every kernel that you're booting in that chain now has to be a secure, right? The kernel's checking for the signatures, right?
It's a little more complicated than that.
Okay.
Whenever you're in UEFI secure mode, one thing you can do is add extra keys into the database of keys that the BIOS knows to trust on a temporary basis. That is how every Linux distribution manages to be secure boot enabled out of the box for those distros that manage it.
Okay.
They start with a very tiny little bootloader that is small enough to be completely audited and that is signed by a key that Microsoft maintains that is embedded in pretty much every x86 compatible firmware on the planet.
Okay.
And when that shim, one of the things that the shim bootloader has is it has an additional key embedded in it that the distro maintainers provide. And that key is what is used to sign the kernel and initrd images that, or sorry, not the kernel and the initrd images directly, but that is what is used to sign the copy of, it's almost always grub that gets loaded afterwards to verify that the grub that is loaded is also trusted by shim and therefore is indirectly trusted by Microsoft. And then grub is responsible for loading the kernel and the initrd, and
each one adds some more keys so that the trust basically expands as you reload each one of these next level shims. Is that?
Yeah, that's pretty much how that works. It's all about building a chain of trust from basically all the way from the whoever is packaging up the kernel all the way back to Microsoft.
Okay, so it's not the firmware each time doing the validation. The firmware does it. Each new bootloader has a way to trust what's going on.
No, the firmware does the checking every time. It's just the individual pieces can add additional trusted keys, provided they are signed by a key that the firmware already trusts.
That's fascinating. Okay.
But that is the difference between secure boot and not secure boot, basically.
I know that we had to tweak our flows for secure boot. I know it's not as simple as just checking secure boot, because you have to make sure that what's made secure boot hard from that perspective?
That we have to know which bootloader to use for every distro we load.
Oh.
That was the fun part. And that actually necessitated a pretty major re-architecture to our DHCP system. And that was one of the driving reasons why we have our own DHCP server, basically. It's so that on every machine, whenever a machine boots, we can go and examine what it's supposed to boot into, see whether or not we have a bootloader that can manage secure boot for it. And if we do, and the license entitlements are correct, we can direct our DHCP server to go use the secure bootloader for that distro. Something Pixie or LPixie Linux or, our embedded grub or whatever.
But those end up being distro specific. You can't have a generic bootloader process if you're going to do secure, because you have to have the ones that match the chain that you're starting on or the chain that you're on for that process. Okay. Which means that you have to detect it. So the only way to do it without that would be to only have one distro, basically. Does this keychain change on these distros over time? Like, even if I was just in a Red Hat distro, then, if I switch from 7 to 8 or 8 to 9, do I then have to, do the keys change too?
I haven't examined that directly. I work under the assumption that they do change, at least with every major release, possibly with minor releases if there are critical security updates.
Makes sense. I mean, well, if the keys compromise, then they're going to change too. So you better be prepared for key rotation at every level, right? Sort of the way I usually think of that from that perspective.
Yeah. And kind of the logic that drove the way we implemented support for Secure Boot was that we need to be able to do this without having any interaction whatsoever at the console. We need to just have a system be in Secure Boot mode, possibly from the factory, and be able to go through our complete inventory, go to install an OS, and go to running a payload without ever having to log onto the console. The reason that comes into play is that the Secure Boot spec allows people to inject their own keys into the firmware and say that they are trusted. The way the spec is implemented, though, is that you have to do that from the console. You can't do that via any kind of scripted interaction or API interaction without going through a significant number of shenanigans that most of our customers really wouldn't be okay with.
Right. Wait, is that to turn on Secure Boot or to turn off Secure Boot or either?
Not to turn on or turn off. That's usually just a BIOS settings update.
Oh, okay.
To inject a key that could be used.
Okay.
We wanted to provide our own iPixie with our own key. In order to get the firmware to trust that, we would have to inject our certificate into the storage space UEFI has for user certificates.
Gotcha. Right. Okay. So like I had heard of a military grade hardware service that was doing exactly that. They were removing the vendor keys and adding their own custom keys in. And then I guess they have to have their own signed bootloaders for all that to work.
Everything.
Okay. I guess but that guarantees that you were the only person who can write an OS that would run on, or can deliver an OS that would run on that system.
Yep. It's very good for that.
Okay.
But it's a lot of effort to maintain if, you know, you don't have a specific mission to do so.
Right. And yeah. But then at that point, though, that machine is functionally bricked. Well, you could conceivably switch it back to legacy mode, I guess, if it had a legacy mode. Assuming you could get access to the firmware.
Assuming you could, but at that point, you'd have to be local enough to get either into the IPMI console or to the physical console. And once you're there, from a security's perspective, the game's over.
Gotcha. So we're covering a lot of the issues I wanted to cover in the discussion, and the security pieces, which I think is really useful. I would move to troubleshooting, but I want to open it up for questions or comments before I shift over. I actually had another question about HTTP versus HTTPS. Is this just a UEFI basically being smart enough and having the root certificates to do HTTPS for that initial download?
Yes, that's part of where HTTPS gets sort of challenging from a UEFI perspective, is that it relies on having the entire certificate infrastructure that makes HTTPS work. And for, client operating systems, that's the sort of stuff that's usually provided by the OS and updated on a regular basis, or provided by your web browser and updated on a regular basis. But those certificate chains can change pretty rapidly in some cases, and no one's going to embed that stuff directly in NIC firmware.
Right. No, it makes sense. I mean, at some point you could just do HTTPS so you get encryption, but just take whatever key, not worry about the chain of trust on the keys.
Yeah.
Which is probably sufficient for what most people would. I mean, at least you're trusting it. Is there, I mean, I know that we get pushback at times on DHCP and Pixie not being secure enough. What are those objections, and are they real? Like, do people really worried about Pixie?
They're very real.
Okay.
On the flip side, they are the tool that we have, and in some cases, they're cemented in place by 30 odd years of legacy use. A lot of these protocols were initially written back in the days when security meant be nice.
Security meant be nice? What?
Yeah. the default implementation of TFTP would let literally anyone who could talk to the device upload an image.
And
whatever image they had, whatever image they could guess a file name to. DHCP, it has no method of authentication or authenticating that this, that the DHCP server you're talking to is the one that you should be talking to or the one they should trust. You know, it can't guard against someone in person. You know, anyone could go and set up a DHCP server on a subnet that has access to the network. And
if they're faster than you are, then you're in trouble. I know we have like a DHCP. There's two things: DHCP proxies and DHCP relays. Mm-hmm. Relay is pretty simple because it's just you're just forwarding. But is DHCP proxy effectively the same thing as what you just described?
No.
Okay.
Sort of. It's not a DHCP proxy. It's specifically an extension to DHCP called proxy DHCP,
where
you can have one DHCP server that's just responsible for handing out addresses and another one that is just responsible for handing out pixie information. And you'll know when you're using an environment that has that, because it'll take a minute or so for it to decide that it can boot. A lot of sites that have that set up, they have it for separation of concerns reason.
Right.
Outside is proxy DHCP is inherently a slow protocol, can't really be made fast.
You've got to respond from two different DHCP servers. Isn't that a bit of a conflict?
You have to have one server that's configured just to respond to pixie options and not to respond to address handout. A lot of like iPixie has specific flags to flat out disable proxy DHCP. Because when it isn't disabled, a boot can take up to a minute to decide that it can't fix you. And that's actually what's responsible for a lot of the lag in firmware once it gets to trying to fix you boot off of multiple NICs. It can talk to the DHCP server, it can get a response back to position address real fast, but it has to sit there and wait for a minute to see if another DHCP server is going to give it fixie information before giving up and moving on.
That actually brings up one of the most common troubleshooting errors that we end up with is just the pixie stuff of DHCP getting lost. So where does this stuff go wrong? I mean, there's a lot of handoffs. There's a lot of bits and pieces to a lot of services to juggle.
Not the way we run things. It's all in one service, which makes troubleshooting.
I know there's times when, you know, if we're seeing somebody not able to pixie boot, is that, you know, I know 9 times out of 10, it feels like it's a firewall problem on the server eating the some part of the protocol. But
I've seen misconfigured firewalls eating DHCP acknowledgements cause the issue. I have seen issues where people are trying to pixie boot servers that are on another continent, and just the sheer latency that you get in TFTP, because it is a very old protocol. It doesn't know about things like pipelining or how to mitigate latency
or lost packets, right? If it's UDP,
It can handle lost packets, but it does so in the simplest possible way that just makes everything much slower. I've seen a lot of that. I have seen issues where switches duplicate traffic due to asymmetric routing. I have seen firmware that decides that any process that takes longer than 5 minutes is failed, even if, you know, there's a continuous stream of packets going back and forth over TFTP. And I've seen all sorts of stuff.
That makes sense. Does switching it to, I mean, if you're using UEFI and HTTP, is that more resilient? Is that just a better approach?
Assuming that the firmware stack supports HTTP in a non-terrible way, yes.
Okay.
You can turn a boot process that takes several minutes into a boot process that takes, you know, seconds. In the aforementioned case of pixie booting, you know, a server that is on another continent. because AGD knows about things like pipelining and, you know, intelligent back off and retry.
So I mean, why does I know that we see relatively slow adoption of UEFI BIOS, like people switching back to legacy mode for that. I mean, it seems like that's always confused me. I don't understand why their resistance from that perspective.
I don't see that as much these days.
Okay.
Mostly because UEFI is the default thing that comes on all your servers unless you specifically ask for legacy.
Right. But then you have to, your boot infrastructure environment has to be able to handle an actual HTTP handoff.
UEFI and HTTP are two different spheres of concerns.
Right.
You have to have UEFI to get HTTP for the most case.
Mm-hmm.
But UEFI over TFTP is still, I think, the way the majority of our clients work.
Why were we disabling it, or why were customers disabling it for all those years? Is it just buggier? Were they worried about it as a protocol?
It was usually slower to boot up.
Huh.
That's largely since mitigated, and now UEFI is every bit as speedy as legacy BIOS on modern servers, because even when you're booting in legacy mode, you're still booting into UEFI first and loading basically a legacy interface for the host to talk to.
So they didn't make it faster, they just made it equally bad.
Yes, they made it equally bad.
It's hilarious.
That's just, I think it took the industry about 15 years to fully adopt to using UEFI firmware as the basis for their stuff instead of legacy mode BIOS as the basis for all their stuff.
Okay. I know that when we were doing some switch automation, the switches were using, they had a different sort of a different strategy, and they had Oni, some guy invented, I talked to the guy who did it at, I forget the name of the turtle open source switch company, the Oni open network.
I think sponsored some of that stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know how I managed to laugh.
Well, I mean, the switches didn't, you're not loading an OS, you're just burning a firmware image. So when I saw this, and when I looked at the Oni pieces, it was literally like all they were trying to do with Oni was, you know, here's a new network OS load. But the guy hated Pixie and something. Anyway, he hated Pixie. The DHCP pieces, and he switched it all to like a chain of HTTP. Like he would look at a given address on the network, and then he would like just go fishing for a file, which strikes me as really actually worse than what we've described with options in DHCP.
It kind of isn't. I mean, the way you do things, you know, it's easier to make it secure by passing along certs and HTTPS along the way.
Okay.
You know, that's UEFI with secure boot kind of mitigates that, because you can't download a malicious payload if it isn't already signed by a key that the firmware trusts.
Okay.
Well, you can download it just won't do anything. He basically, it sounds like he just wanted to kind of reinvent a better wheel instead of leveraging technology.
Yes, I talked to him about it, and that was, he was basically like, I don't like this, I'm going to invent a new one. There's a significant amount of what came before me is by default bad, by definition bad, and I have to re-architect.
But, which is funny, because it goes back to what he was trying to do is basically recapitulating what Klaus was talking about with thin client.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it's the switches are very similar, right? There is no, you're not trying to bootstrap an OS by getting sequentially more impactful kernels. You're just saying, this is my gear. I need you to reimage the firmware on it. Which is very much like a thin client approach. Yeah, from what you're describing, right, we're moving into basically a flexible, the bootstrap process gives you a flexible kernel. The flexible kernel lets you do you could do almost anything at that point, which is good, but you have to control that.
Yeah, it's also, before secure boot was bad because the kernel could literally do anything. And in UEFI, it could literally do anything while running in a trusted context of, being essentially in the firmware execution space.
Right. So how do you, that makes sense. Okay. Did we miss something in this process? I think we covered what I was hoping to for DHCP. I know from when we look at this, we've covered a lot of the pieces. And so we wrote this graph almost, I'd have to look at the, let me see. Oh, only 5 years ago.
We should probably update it so that it's UEFI as an example.
We should. And part of what I'm hoping we're accomplishing here is talking this through so people understand what's happening with UEFI. And we didn't touch on things like doing this process without having a DHCP boot. You can't get it on the network without, well, you could pre-wire. I mean, when we do a media attach, are we preloading those attached medias with enough bootstrap information that you can avoid the whole DHCP cycle and the options? I know that's a huge topic in itself. So,
for booting purposes, yes, DHCP is generally still, DHCP at some point is generally still involved, at least to get the out of band controller.
Okay.
Configured, unless you have someone that wants to do it all static, we can make it work that way too. But we've had wanderers way afar of anything vaguely related to these.
Wow, I am really enjoying this Tech Ops series where we take these core infrastructure concepts and we dig deep in them towards the idea of building a curriculum, this educational material, so that we can help operators understand these advanced concepts. If you don't understand how these systems fit together, how these processes work, it is impossible to automate them in an effective way. And that's what we're doing with this Tech Ops series. And I'm super proud of the content that we're building and the discussions that we're having. If you find this valuable, and I hope you do, please check out our at the2030.cloud. Join the conversations. Let us know of topics that you want to hear more about. They are really fantastic, interesting topics, and we're going to be pulling all this together and creating ultimately a book, I think, about what this is. So hope to see you there. Thank you for listening to the Cloud 2030 podcast. It is sponsored by RackN, where we are really working to build a community of people who are using and thinking about infrastructure differently, because that's what RackN does. We write software that helps put operators back in control of distributed infrastructure, really thinking about how things should be run and building software that makes that possible. If this is interesting to you, please try out the software. We would love to get your opinion and hear how you think this could transform infrastructure more broadly, or just keep enjoying the podcast and coming to the discussions and laying out your thoughts and how you see the future unfolding, all part of building a better infrastructure operations community. Thank you.